Subscribe to our free podcasts at abc.net.au/rn.
This is Big Ideas on RN. I'm Paul Barclay. Thanks for joining me tonight. What rights do carers have? Well, according to public policy researcher Dr. Marilyn Waring, the bottom line is they have no human rights. She spent the past 25 years working to empower women and men to challenge the priorities imposed by mainstream economics. And she no longer believes we should put a monetary value on unpaid work. Instead, she's developed a human rights approach that puts women and other vulnerable people at the centre, asking what would make the life of carers, who are mostly women, easier, safer and freer. Marilyn Waring is a former MP in the New Zealand Parliament, advisor to the UN, board member of the Reserve Bank of New Zealand and a winner of numerous awards. In this year's Pamela Dunoon lecture, Professor Waring sets out her current thinking around what she has called the economics of dignity.
Kia ora tātou. Can I please give my respects to the Indigenous people of this place? I bring these greetings from Taupiri, my moanga, Waikato, Te Awa. I'm very honoured to be invited to give the Pamela Dunoon lecture for 2015. Pamela seems to my reading to have been an active feminist in all her activities, and with her significant involvement, the women's electoral lobby was very effective in Australia, and the same organisation was of major support and comfort to me in my New Zealand parliamentary years. Pamela studied politics and sociology, read widely in feminist theory, and was committed to issues of social justice. I have fashioned my address this evening to reflect Pamela's passionate political work for equality for women. I'm going to talk about human rights and a great deal of women's unpaid work. Sometimes this is called care work, but I have a major critical analysis of that particular framing, which I also want to share with you this evening. We all know women have been the unpaid workers in households and for families for millennia. And as any of this work moved into the market, women occupied the gender-stereotyped low-paid positions, which replaced the unpaid work. In the 21st century, globalisation of this significant labour sector has seen many of these positions occupied by ethnic or migrant workers. And in 2015, demographic projections challenge governments on how to cope with the increasing number of dependents, and in particular the elderly, who need a range of assistance to provide, to survive. If we think about who provides this assistance, there's a long list. Armstrong, for example, describes Canadian long-term residential care interests as including governments at multiple levels, national and international level for-profit and not-for-profit organisations, professions, unions, community organisations and other groups representing various publics, residents, families, volunteers. Now, the key question for me is what options are there to change the dynamic of centuries-old expectations of women taking on this unpaid family and household work and or the underpaid market equivalents? And what are the issues for female human rights and dignity, and what might care really mean? Because I give this address coming from a personal experience of living and being in the so-called care environment, and more of that later, because for 14 months I managed the care and cared for my father after melanoma roots invaded the nerve tunnels to the brain stem. He was at home until the last 5 weeks. And in these 5 weeks, he told me that he felt he had lost his sanity and his dignity. It's an interesting word, dignity. It's the most fundamental of human rights. Article 1 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights states that all human beings are born free and equal in dignity and rights. My father knew exactly what he meant when he lost his dignity. For instance, when I insisted that my dad needed to be helped, to be fed, they replied that they did not want to undermine his independence. He had palsy, a swollen tongue, had mostly lost his capacity to swallow, and poured food down his front to his shoes whenever he tried to help himself. My dad wanted his dignity, not his independence. We may not have studied dignity in philosophy or law classes, but I suggest we all know a loss of dignity when we see it or experience it. We expect to find dignity in the constitutions of Germany and South Africa, given histories of Nazism and apartheid. Philosophers such as Kant and Dworkin have contended that it's impossible to separate self-respect from respect for the importance of the lives of others. When I treat others with indignity, I'm also debasing my own humanness. There have been criticisms made of UN human rights covenants in general, that the rights and laws are individualistic, not collective or communitarian, and yet many indignities are aimed at peoples, communities, indigenous and cultural minorities. At the same time, dignity can't be wrapped up in a rigid box of meaning. As human dignity applies to our individual lives in all of their riot of difference, there must be always room for the application of the concept, though, in policy directed towards strategic, practical outcomes. And sometimes it does get to be tied down. A major breakthrough in the human rights issues in the field of those being cared for and those doing the caring was made when Cheryl and Philip Hutchinson took on the Ministry of Health and Senior Citizens of British Columbia in the Human Rights Commission of British Columbia. The case focused on the validity of a ministry policy which prohibited the hiring of immediate family members by adults with disabilities. These adults, they qualified for and received ministry funding to cover the cost of long-term in-house care services. But the policy constituted a blanket prohibition against hiring family members and applied regardless of whether the funding arrangement involved direct payment to the individual or was through a homemaker agency as an approved service provider. Ms. Hutchinson was born with cerebral palsy, a condition which led to physical limitations in her childhood and quadriplegia in her adult life. I might say that at the age of 30, when she took this case, she was a very proficient composer and earned significant money in doing this music composition. At the time of the case, though, in 2004, she required assistance in all aspects of daily living, including bathing, dressing, toileting, transfers, mobility, and meal preparation. Ms. Hutchinson's father, Philip Hutchinson, had been her primary caregiver since she was 13 years old. In her view, her father was, and continued to be, her most appropriate caregiver, and a major contributing factor to her success, her accomplishments, and her independence in the face of her disability. In order to provide his daughter with the assistance she required, Mr. Hutchinson was forced to leave the workforce, and the family had subsisted primarily on the limited funds available through social assistance since 1983. At the time of the hearing, Mr. Hutchinson was 71 years old and continued to be his daughter's primary caregiver. Now, in 1998, Cheryl Hutchinson had been accepted as a client of something called Choices in Supports for Independent Living. This was a ministry-funded program that provided funds directly to qualified adults with disabilities, allowing them some discretion to hire their own caregivers. But the ministry policy prohibited Ms. Hutchinson from hiring her father to provide for her care using these funds. Now, Mr. Hutchinson didn't want to be his daughter's sole assistant. He realised he would not be able to do this work for his daughter for forever, and he wanted her to be independent. He did, however, wish to be able to be hired as one of his daughter's support workers in the so-called Choices scheme. Cheryl and Philip Hutchinson both filed human rights complaints, alleging that the ministry's policy prohibiting the hiring of family members under the Choices program was discriminatory. Ms. Hutchinson alleged that the ministry's policy discriminated against her on the grounds of disability and family status, contrary to the code. Mr. Hutchinson alleged that the ministry's policy discriminated against him on the grounds of family status and breach of the code. And both workers, both the worker, Mr. Hutchinson, and his daughter, also complained about treatment of indignity. The case was very tightly constructed, so it couldn't be seen as a universal remedy for all family members who are subject, in many countries, to this sort of discrimination. The complainants didn't challenge the validity of the general prohibition. What was challenged was the blanket prohibition against the hiring of family members without an individual assessment under the Choices program. And the judgment is very instructive as to the part played by loss of dignity in human rights cases. In Ms. Hutchinson's case, the blanket policy against hiring family members had a significant adverse impact on her dignity, given her high care needs and her difficulties in hiring and retaining appropriate support workers. The policy did not address her actual needs as a vulnerable person with a severe disability. On the one hand, it offered her the opportunity to choose her own support workers, and on the other, it denied her the opportunity to hire her father, her most appropriate caregiver. The tribunal found that the blanket prohibition against hiring family members impacted most severely on those like Ms. Hutchinson, who were severely disabled and required 24-hour care with all of the intimate activities of daily living. It concluded that she had established a prima facie case of discrimination on the basis of disability and found that the ministry's blanket prohibition against the hiring of relatives offended the code on the basis of family status. It also found that Mr. Hutchinson had been discriminated against in seeking employment with no consideration of his qualifications or of his suitability to do the job, and that both Hutchinsons had had their dignity violated. In New Zealand, a similar story has played out when a group of parents who were the 24/7 carers of adult children with disabilities and who were not paid for their work complained to the Human Rights Commission. The Atkinson case was won in the Equal Opportunities Tribunal, was won in the High Court, and was won in the Court of Appeal. And then the National Party government decided to ignore court rulings, to take away the right to recompense, and introduced an ouster condition preventing any further challenges to the law in similar cases. This happened in a context in New Zealand where the 24/7 carers of those whose disability is the result of an accident are entitled to be paid under the New Zealand Accident Compensation regime. That seems to me to provide a very interesting footing for questions of human rights issues and dignity of both those needing support work and those family members providing it. But are there other or further human rights issues for those responsible for the unpaid work with respect to 24/7 dependents? Well, dignity was really influencing my thinking when I was invited to work in a Commonwealth Secretariat team with Robert Carr, Anit Mukherjee and Meena Shivdas on research on the 24/7 caregivers of those with HIV and AIDS in 11 Commonwealth countries. We didn't make it easy for ourselves. We purposively, the word we use in academic circles to mean on purpose, selected participants, including grandmothers, children who were in charge of the care, gay men, intravenous drug users, prisoners, rural people, transgender persons as participants in our research in both developed and so-called developing member states of the Commonwealth. And our work was undertaken in an economic climate where the strategy has been to discharge patients early from public care facilities. I'm sure that that's mimicked still in Australia. In many countries where HIV and AIDS is of epidemic proportions and hospitals cannot cope, they have just sent home all patients. In making this policy choice, there is a presumption that there's a reserve army of unpaid labour available in the family or community, sitting about, doing nothing else, to immediately resume responsibility for the discharged patient. We know nobody's sitting around doing nothing else to care for these people. So obviously, time taken in that care must mean time taken from other activities. And there are significant economic costs to any national budget in respect of the invisibility of unpaid household and community work, especially in this presumption that you have time available. We know this from the growing number of national and other time use data sets, from surveys or pilot studies on unpaid work and healthcare, from decades of narrative captured in a wide range of social science literature, and from our own observations and experience. Insufficient or inadequate care at the onset of illness can exacerbate its severity, with costs incurred across sectors. This occurs from the loss of labour from the market sector, the loss or diminution of unpaid service, productive and reproductive activities, either when the woman in the home is ill or when she has to forego other daily household tasks to carry out the caring work, or when a child is removed from school to assist in unpaid work, and with the known outcomes of longer-term illness, increasing the possibilities of poverty, poor nutrition and hunger, and a range of other vulnerabilities. It's also important to remember that in addition to work directly related to assisting dependents, right, household work, the daily maintenance of well-being has to continue. So we have this work assisting dependents, but we also have to continue household access to water, hygienic practices, transportation, a clean environment, along with the management and logistics of all expectations. These are daily chores that cannot be neglected, whether or not anybody inside the household is ill. Needs don't happen according to a daily timetable when somebody is ill. The work is very complex and difficult, and the things to do are very many. Now, I said earlier, I've got a major issue with the use of the terms carer, caregiver, and care economy for all this unpaid work. Because it seems to me that what happens when one of those terms is used is all of a sudden all the other unpaid work becomes invisible, and the person suddenly is just a carer. Now, these terms also do not describe the management, logistics, administration, resource mobilisation, transportation, food production, quite apart from preparation, and coordination that are all necessary if you are caregiving. I have a student writing a case study in New Zealand of a mother of a teenage girl with multiple complex severe health issues. She has had in the last 2 years to deal with 22 personnel from 18 different agencies. Can you imagine the work? The forms, the phone calls, the frustration, the time, all of that, as well as all the so-called housework, as well as all the primary caregiving. Where is any of this visible in the use of the word caregiver? If the work, it seems to me, if the work has to be done in an institution for a dependent resident, it then has to be done in the household for a dependent. Every process in the first one is performed in microcosm in the second one without the paid army of labour.
Author, scholar, environmentalist and social justice activist Dr. Marilyn Waring with this year's Pamela Dunoon lecture and her concept of the economics of dignity. This is Big Ideas on RN. Let's continue now with Marilyn Waring's talk.
Let's look at what this work involves from at least two perspectives of the so-called developing and developed world. Now, the Commonwealth team decided that we would use a Murchison's capability approach to look at the work of the carers. It's a human rights approach. And we developed questions directly from the Convention on the Elimination of Discrimination Against Women, directly from the Convention on the Rights of Children, from the Civil and Political Covenant, from the Economic, Social and Cultural Covenants. So, for example, we would ask, do you feel that you had any choice about becoming a caregiver? Does anyone ever come to give you rest? Rest and recreation are human rights. How is your own health? Can you describe the meals you have during a day? Are you able to do any work outside the home? Are you able to go to community or political meetings, etc.? Drawing off the specific paragraphs of these rights bodies. Now, some of you may know that the Pamela Dunoon Trust provides bursaries for young Papua New Guinea women to finish their schooling. So I've chosen one of our Papua New Guinea participants as the voice responding to this question. I am 46 years old. I have been a widow for over 10 years now. I cared for my eldest child, Bethia, who was 24 years old when she died. My daughter was living at home with me when she got sick. I took her to the barracks clinic, which is about a mile from our home. They said she had malaria and pneumonia. It was only later I heard from others that she had HIV and later AIDS. Whenever she was angry, I would sit beside her and rub her back to calm her because gossip really affected her. I could not buy her the food she wanted to eat because I didn't have money. But I still tried to do what I could. Our ways of getting food was difficult. My sons were little boys when I took them out of school to help me. You have to fish. You have to go to the market and sell the fish, buy whatever food you can, buy what she would like, whatever she wants, beg from our extended family. They were only young, but they were trying to do the job of a man. Her brothers and sister were scared, and at times they hated her. She really wanted hot water and sometimes cold, and I'd ask around and try to find some cold water for her. I alone washed her, as no one else was there to help me wash her or do anything else for her. Our own family turned away from us. Nobody came to help. With three little children to look after as well, I could not afford to get sick. It was very hard. My water fetching and means of earning some income through selling shellfish and beads or shell necklaces stopped. My time was totally taken up with her, washing her, feeding her, washing her again and putting her to sleep. I would go to the barracks clinic and ask for medicine. If they had none, I'd have to find money and go to the pharmacy and try and buy medicine. And medicine was very expensive. In caring for her, I would help her around. I would dress her, lie her down, help her up. If she wanted to go to the toilet, I would dig a hole beside the house and lift her and help her outside to do her business, and then I would bury it. I'd place a mat on the ground outside for her to sit on, and I would wash her. I didn't only wash her in fresh water, I couldn't afford it. Sometimes I took her down to the sea and washed her there and then brought her back to the house and washed her again in warm water. I'd heat the water and massage her body and dress her in clean clothes. By this stage, she was very weak, and at that time I just kept buying clothes from the second hand because she was soiling them and I wouldn't have enough time to wash them and no one wanted to touch her clothes. We had to collect water in containers from the barracks. It's a mile, you know. If we were lucky, someone would be driving along the road and we'd get a lift. And if not, we'd just walk it there and back. I'd wash and dress her in the morning, again at 10 in the morning, then in the afternoon, and then at night, and I'd wash her again to dress her ready for sleep. I realized that during this time, I was hungry all the time. We didn't see any counsellors or anyone. I asked around, but nothing came our way. When she died, I sent a message to my family to ask them to come and help me. No one came. I washed her and dressed her on my own and waited. Only one lady came forward, and with her help, I lifted her body into the coffin. After she died, the people from the AIDS clinic came and did a workshop here. And they asked me all sorts of questions about how I looked after her. Where were they when she was alive? Now that she was dead, they wanted to know everything. Now, one of the very clear findings from our research was that few carers had any human rights at all. They did not choose their work. They had no choice. They had no time to do anything else, no time to enjoy their capabilities, their rights. And in our research, we argued for a finding of what we called capability servitude. That is, no choice to do anything else, as the experience of most of these carers. Now, what might be the equivalent in the West? And for much of what I now say, I use the word care with all the major reservations already expressed, and largely because the information collected in the West asks people about the amount of time they spend caring. Now, I suspect when you ask somebody about the amount of time that they spend caring, and don't suggest to them that you also want all the management, administrative, coordination, logistics work as well, that perhaps they don't tell you that part. And perhaps they also leave out all the other unpaid household work that they have to do as well. I'm going to start with the United Kingdom Census of 2001, which was the first to include a question on health, disability, and the provision of care. It showed that more than a million people were working more than 50 hours a week unpaid to care for family members, friends, neighbours and others because of long-term physical or mental ill health or disability and problems related to old age. In the UK, in 2001, so the numbers lifted, more than 175,000 children under 18 were acting as carers, including 13,000 children under 18, providing more than 50 hours of care a week. Of people aged 65 and over, more than 400,000 cared more than 50 hours a week, and fewer than a third of those were in good health themselves. If they had been paid employees rather than informal carers, it would have been in contravention of the European Working Time Directive. In 2010, the BBC surveyed 4,000 secondary school pupils and found an invisible army of 8% of them working in their households as carers. This was considerably larger than the census figures, but academics who designed the questionnaire said the stigma of admitting some disabilities and the stigma of admitting that children were caregivers meant that there was always going to be underrepresentation in the census figures. Indeed, the figures in the 2007-08 Scottish Household Survey showed up to 100,000 young carers just in Scotland. And when I was reading the Scottish work, I was very interested in reflections from research on young carers in a project in Stirling who appeared to have capability issues similar to those that we'd found in our Commonwealth research. A lack of transport, a lack of services, few, if any, shops with fresh produce to enable healthy eating, very long school journeys, which they often didn't make, and few leisure activities. Now, I'm especially interested in this as the Scottish government is moving towards carers' assessments, as well as assessments of those who use services. And I would hope, and have been agitating for, a capability assessment based on human rights to be a basic ingredient of the assessments for both the carer and the person being cared for. I've been particularly interested in the new regulations in Scotland, which set out the circumstances where a supported person can employ a close relative as their personal assistant and support person. Listen carefully. These include where a person requires palliative care, where there are limited service providers, and where there are religious and cultural beliefs. So the range of appropriate circumstances do not pass the Hutchinson test, being the best possible carer available and being the carer of choice for the patient and having both parties left with their dignity. When we think of all the hours of unpaid work, what is the single largest sector in any economy, we know overwhelmingly that women do this work. Now, can we think of any equivalent treatment of anything that men did for centuries unpaid? Absolutely, I heard it. Yes, it was called slavery. And yes, there are a small number of men, some of them gay men, caring for partners, among those doing this unpaid work, and in their cases, they are often wearing the indignity of stigma and discrimination, and often hiding, because there are still sanctions for homosexual men on the statute books. We are aware of an increase as well in older men performing caregiving roles with their partners. Now let's look at the human rights of those employed in the market doing frontline caring work. In early February 2015, The Guardian Weekly reported that in the United Kingdom, around 160,000 care workers out of 1.4 million were being paid less than the national minimum wage, each losing about £815 a year. Overwhelmingly women and often migrants, the wage theft was mainly caused by employers not paying staff for time travelling between clients, despite a legal ruling that it must count towards a care worker's hours. They were also not paying for unpaid training, and they were not paying for on-call time. In a mirror image, the Employment Court in New Zealand ruled last month that 35,000 women workers in New Zealand have been systematically exploited by being paid subsidies in a form of deliberate servitude. Relief carers have not been paid even the minimum wage, not paid for travel time, and in some cases have earned no more than $3 an hour for their relief care in the families of 24/7 carers. In New Zealand, other landmark cases have included the case for hourly pay for those on sleepover shifts at IHS homes and a breakthrough ruling on equal pay. Because in October 2004, the New Zealand Court of Appeal ruled in favour of an aged care worker that the Equal Pay Act of 1972 meant that women have a right to be paid the same as men doing a different job if the work is comparable. The judges said the existence of entire industries that may be underpaid because they are female-dominated was undoubtedly something of concern to the 1972 Parliament. That might be contested. I served with a lot of them. However, I definitely celebrate the Court of Appeal judgment. But isn't it interesting how there can be no reliance on Parliament now to affect the human rights of workers even in the paid sector, and recourse must be made time and again to the courts? But there remains a major difference between paid and unpaid work and its treatment. For those of you familiar with my work, you'll know in the United Nations System of National Accounting Rules, which determine the boundary of production for what does and does not count as work, unpaid work, when carried out in the household, is specifically excluded from the statistics which determine the gross domestic product. In economic theory, the unpaid work of caring is interesting in its challenge to the Chicago School because it illustrates the space which most challenges this dominant paradigm. The Chicago man is out there, of course, busy acting in his own self-interest and self-actualizing. But caregiving is a complete contradiction to this framing. The needs of the other come first. And those are the starting point for the carer, not maximising their own rational self-interest. But when I was taking unpaid, we've got to be careful here, because when I was taking unpaid care of my father, I don't believe that there could be a suggestion that I was more imbued with selfless motivations which would improve his quality of care. It started as a loving relationship and concluded as obligation, I assure you, compared with the young male Filipina nurse who took over in the last 5 weeks with more skills, experience, expertise, and patience than I could ever muster. I would not wish to argue that the nurse's only motivation was the market income he would receive, and it was my observation that care was a professional characteristic that he practiced in all his waged work. As part of my re-entry to the academic world after caring, I was able to attend a lecture given in Auckland by Sue Yandel from the Centre for International Research on Care, Labour and Equality at the University of Leeds. Sue spoke about the reconciliation of work and care and support to worker carers, outlining the UK experience of employer-based approaches for those who retained their role in the paid labour force while needing to care for household members. She advised that there were 6.5 million people in the UK now in this particular cohort. The Carers UK, which has been in operation for some decades, had valued unpaid care work in its narrow definition at £119 billion a year. This exceeded the total cost of the national health budget and was more than four times what all local authorities spent on social services. I had an instinct about this £119 billion figure, so I asked her how did they determine it in respect of the various options that are available in economics. There's a generalised replacement cost, which you usually work out per hour at minimum wage or really low wage. There's the specialised replacement cost, where you get to involve physiotherapy, dieticians, speech therapists, chefs, etc., which of course gives you a much greater figure. And this opportunity cost. Sue explained that they chose the generalised replacement cost because it was the lowest cost from the different estimation models, and the figure was so enormous they didn't want to scare the horses. So Sue then described the Care Act of 2014, which places a new duty on all English local authorities to plan sufficient care services and to enable carers to be in paid work. Sue then outlined the evolution of an organisation called Employers for Carers. In 2002, Carers UK had drawn together an employers interest group supported by the EU Action for Carers and Employment. The strategic interest was that the carers risked falling out of employment. Carers who were in paid employment had a right to work and a right to access employment. The Carers Employment and Services Study of 2007 showed that over 40% of carers were supporting someone where needs had not been assessed or where there was no support from any service. The demographic projections showed a potential for greater pressures on organisations with staff needing to become carers. And in 2014, the chairman of Employers for Carers and managing director of British Gas, Ian Petrie, had stated, quote, "Those people caring are likely to be your most experienced members of staff," end quote. Sue explained that Carers UK inquiry 2014 showed that 70% of carers were £10,000 or more per annum worse off as a result of their reduced earnings. But hang on a minute, I piped up. That's an opportunity cost figure, not a replacement cost figure. So when the care economy is to be co-opted in the interests of employers, capital, and the market, we use the highest replacement estimate. Now, what's important in this version of the care economy is what the market is missing out on, not the intangibles of care that none of us can put a value on. I know of only one major national initiative which has been introduced and which works. Long-term care insurance was implemented in South Korea on August 1st, 2008. to reduce the burden of care on family members and to provide for a rapidly expanding older demographic. The South Korean government faced a choice between provision of services and the payment of a benefit to those in need to purchase those services. Now, you'll also recognise in South Korea, for probably centuries, there's been an expectation that you, the wife, the mum, look after your parents and his parents, regardless. And also, of course, in the last 40 to 50 years, the South Korean government has been desperate to get its mature women into its paid workforce to increase its gross domestic product. Now, a countrywide feminist response from women when they were told a choice between provision of services or the payment of a benefit to those in need was that elderly men would just spend any money on gambling, smoking, drinking, and their social life, and women would still be expected to do the unpaid caring. "We won't do it," was the loud message for the government. So long-term care insurance was introduced. There are payments from insurance companies, from the government, and from everybody in paid work. So it also has that accruing savings, which every government likes, sitting over here in a big pool, assisting all your accounting frameworks. But it is a kind of compulsory weekly provision from three different payees. Now, elderly recipients' eligibility is dependent on the certification from the long-term care insurance, and based on their individual needs, care is then mainly delivered in kind according to the wishes of the client. And the client has the freedom to choose their service provider. And long-term care benefits consist of community-based home care and institutional care, and sometimes cash benefits, but in the minority of situations. Now, this, if you'd been the Korean government and you'd planned for implementation in August 2008, you probably would have been tearing your hair out, given that it was to be introduced in the middle of the global financial crisis. And you knew that welfare expenditure and pension spending were rapidly rising, and that this insurance and meeting the needs of the elderly would also see an increase in spending. However, there were outcomes nobody had foreseen. First of all, healthy ageing of the elderly population, with everyone being assessed, has resulted in a decrease in healthcare spending and a decrease in hospitalisation for the elderly from an average of 16 to 11 days. The increase in healthy elderly means more elderly are remaining in the working population, paying tax, and 96% of the families of the elderly have reported that the insurance has helped them participate in economic activity, all of which benefits tax revenue. In comparison with the other sectors where employment levels decreased or were stable because of the economic recession in 2008, health and social work, which includes the insurance caring industry, were the exception. Workers at LTCI facilities increased by more than 190,000. Now, I don't know whether these are Chinese and Filipino, and I'm sorry, I don't know about their working conditions, but that's an exceptional figure. But in addition to that, there were increased workers in other sectors, including more than 40,000 new positions in technological innovation and manufacturing and elder care support. Isn't it amazing how much technological innovation can be done when it's for the market? That's a very economic transformation of the care economy. And the sheer volume of work in this sector is increasing so rapidly, many governments are just responding as the New Zealand government has. Shut it down, say no, change the laws, keep it at home, we can't afford it. It's the typically male Chicago man response, lacking in any imagination, good strategic design, a willingness to pay attention to a huge issue in a very large economic sector where all engaged are counted. South Korea has shown us a way, and it's in all of our interests to pay good attention to every one of these issues. We're all heading there, either as carers or as those who will need care. Thank you.
Marilyn Waring. Let's hear now some of the audience questions that followed Marilyn Waring's talk. Firstly, a comparison of our Australian National Disability Scheme with the long-term care insurance in South Korea, which was mentioned. The South Korean model is focused on the elderly, while the Australian scheme is cutting them out.
As I understand it, it's much closer to the New Zealand Accident Compensation Scheme than to the Korean insurance scheme. And the interesting thing for me in Korea is you're old, you're assessed. Nobody misses out. You know, it's not like you hit that age, you're in. And the various assessments range from, you know, just 5% of some kind of input that might be a technological assist, as it were, right through to 100%. The New Zealand Accident Compensation Scheme's author, really, Owen Woodhouse, was the person who interested me in the effects of unpaid work. He wrote his report in 1972, and in his report he had said that all unpaid household workers also ought to be compensated because there was a disruption to service, reproductive and productive work in the household that may well have to be replaced, and a disturbance to the support given to others who were active in the market economy. And of course, when it was introduced, household workers were left completely out. And so I've been kind of on the case ever since.
Another woman in the audience asked, what's the place of ordinary childcare as opposed to disability childcare in all of this?
Yeah, well, this opens us up to a huge other question. But it seems to me that governments move to make interventions that make it possible for more people to work in the market economy. So childcare means we can get more of you into the market economy. And that over and over again, whether they're issues of equal pay, flexible working, etc., etc., the imperative for governments is how can we get more bodies in the market and keep them there? We can compare this, for example, with governmental failure almost everywhere to do an opportunity cost assessment of male violence and put as many resources into stopping male violence as they do into assisting the market.
That was this year's Pamela Dunoon lecture with social activist Dr. Marilyn Waring. As always, you can leave your comments on our website. Simply head to abc.net.au/rn and check out the Big Ideas page. I'm Paul Barclay. Until tomorrow night, bye for now.
Tony Abbott has pleaded,
pull back from this brink.
And if that doesn't move Joko Widodo and spare the lives of two young Australians facing the death penalty in Indonesia, then there's also this warning.
We will certainly be finding ways to make our displeasure felt.
So what will be the repercussions? Join me, Tom Switzer, for a discussion on the state of Australian-Indonesian relations on Between the Lines. online anytime at the RN homepage.